Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute on this hot and humid Sydney evening. And many thanks to Coors Chambers Westgarth for the use of this facility. Stan Grant makes a welcome first-time appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's very well known to all of you, so I'll introduce him briefly. He's now Indigenous Affairs Editor of the ABC and Chair of Indigenous Affairs at Charles Sturt University, and he's about to commence 7:30 Friday, which will be the 7:30 program on Friday once a week. Stan won the 2015 Walkley Award for his coverage of Indigenous affairs and is the author of The Tears of Strangers and Talking to My Country, and most recently of The Australian Dream, Blood, History and Becoming. And we've got copies of all three books here tonight. So I just welcome Stan to talk on the general topic of The Australian Dream, Blood, History and Becoming. Many thanks.
Thank you very much, Jared, and a real pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for coming along. It feels like Hong Kong, doesn't it? I lived in Hong Kong for some time, and I was saying to Jared on the way up here, just walking down here, I felt, you know, in Hong Kong you need to have 3 showers a day, and I felt like that once again. I want to just begin by paying my respects to the traditional people of this land, indeed an ancestry that I draw my own from, and very proud to say so. We're standing here right near Circular Quay, and before I begin the substance of the speech, I just want to tell you a little bit about my own connection to this place. In the 1870s, a young boy was living at Circular Quay in the boat sheds with the remnants of the first people of this area. This new metropolis had grown up around them, and they'd been forced from their own lands. He was a young boy. His father died and was found dead on the streets. There was an inquest into his death, and subsequently the Aborigines Protection Board was established, and he was moved with the rest of his family out west and merged with the Wiradjuri people, and he was my great-great-grandfather. But his grandparents were on the shore at Botany Bay when first Cook in 1770 and then the first fleet arrived in 1788. It is a connection directly to that moment of first contact, of which I'm very proud, and it really leads me into discussing what I'm here to talk about tonight. Each year I like to go back and revisit a favourite book from my childhood, to read it again as an adult and see how it speaks to me. And this year I reread Eleanor Dark's classic Australian novel, The Timeless Land, written in the 1940s. Some of you may remember it from your own childhoods and having to study it at high school, but it's an extraordinary book. It imagines the birth of modern Australia. It's a poetic meditation, really, on the collision of old worlds and new. She opens seeing the world through the eyes of the boy Bennelong. Dark places Bennelong with his father on a cliff face looking out at the ocean. Only 6 years old, he was expected to act as a man. She writes he was conscious of the world, conscious of himself as part of it, fitting into it, belonging to it, drawing strength and joy and existence from it, like a bee in the frothing yellow opulence of the wattle. Dark imagines a blue cloudless sky, the sea a silver line, the surf breaking on the rocks below. Bennelong was tired, but his father didn't notice. He kept his eyes peeled for the boat with wings. He had been looking year after year for that after that strange morning many seasons ago when a magic boat had flown into the harbour. It had folded its wings like a seagull and come to rest. From the boat came mysterious beings with faces pale as bones. Bennelong had been told this story in corroboration of how these strangers came and left as suddenly. It was long ago and the memory of the magic boat had faded, but Bennelong's father remembered. And so they came to stand on the rock and watch and wait for the white face's eventual return. So vivid was Dark's recreation that as I read it, I felt that I was the young boy himself standing with his father his head filled with old stories, imagining and dreaming. She wrote, Bennelong stared at it, the unending water. He looked up at his father's lean figure, still motionless, still watching for the boat with wings. And there was born in him a conviction which all through his boyhood was to tease him now and then. That the water was not really unending after all. That somewhere, far, far away, there lay another land. That someday he, Bennelong, not in a bark canoe, but in a boat with wings, would go in search of it. Eleanor Dark captures a process of becoming. It is the spark of humanity, the ability to think of worlds beyond one's own. The philosopher Hegel saw this as the process of becoming. To Hegel, being and non-being existed at once, part of each other, being and nothing. In this we preserve difference and the difference, he wrote, from difference. Being is our destruction and our preservation. To Hegel, we live in a succession of nows, a present, a before and after, and a future that in its turn will become a past. To quote Hegel himself, time appears as the very fate and necessity of spirit when it is not in itself complete. World history, writes Hegel, is the interpretation of spirit in time. The Polish Nobel Prize-winning poet Czesław Miłosz wondered about this journey of time and people, this quest of the spirit, in his poem, The Spirit of History. He writes, amid thunder, the golden house of is collapses and the process of becoming ascends. Certainty, being, gone, and ahead, possibility and change, the inevitability of unrelenting change. Miłosz writes, you without beginning, you always between. And here is Dark's Bennelong, a boy becoming, a boy on a cliff face awaiting the return of the bone-pale people in the ship with wings. Bennelong would take that journey, touching a shore far from his home. Miłosz wrote of the darkness of 20th century Europe, a continent awash in blood where memory, he wrote, was the memory of wounds. This too was a time of people becoming, forged by war and tyranny, making a new peace. As he wrote in Elegy for NN, you got used to new wet winters, to a villa where the blood of the German owner was washed from the wall and he never returned. I too accepted but what was possible, cities and countries. One cannot step twice into the same lake. My ancestors were born into this world of new winters, accepting, as Miłosz said, but what was possible, formed by it as it formed around them. Their ancestry reached deep into the story of human occupation on this continent. I am drawn from the Wiradjuri and Gamilaroi people of New South Wales, but my story also comes from the green fields of Tipperary in Ireland. There at the dawn of the 19th century, a young man was banished, transported in chains, never to see his home again. Home now would be a land far away, a dry and parched place, brown and cracked. The blood of these people, white and black, runs through me. My personal journey really mirrors the journey of this country, how to reconcile not just our history, but in my case, my very DNA. Each January 26, I reflect on the history that has placed me here. So it was this Australia Day. This year, my father received an award from the town of Narandra, where he lives in New South Wales. It was in recognition for his work teaching Wiradjuri language, a language of his forebears that was in danger of disappearing. He has previously been awarded an Order of Australia for the same work. It is a source of great pride for a man who has lived much of his life at the coalface of poverty and often bigotry. Yet he reaches across the black-white divide, a man who's always been focused more on what unites us. That night I spoke to my mother, and she too was proud of my dad's achievements, yet she reminded me, and she often does this, of another history. She told me of seeing her father handcuffed, tied to a tree, left all day in the blazing sun for the crime then in the 1940s of drinking alcohol. She told me again of her mother, a white woman, turned away from hospital when she was about to give birth to an Aboriginal man's child. She spoke of that night when police came at gunpoint and a bulldozer rolled over the tin humpy on the outskirts of town that she and her family called home. On this Australia Day, my mother quietly said, "It wouldn't hurt if they changed the date." This is not the ranting of a flag-burning protester. This is a dignified, quiet woman in her 70s who has raised her children to be proud and strong, living with a man she has shared her life with, but reflecting on a country that has, at times, laid them low. We draw our identities from these stories. Academic Bronwyn Carlson, herself an Indigenous woman, has written of this often precarious and fragile sense of identity, buttressed by a sense of pan-Indigenous unity, built around shared injustice, an experience of racism, and often a rejection of whiteness. This identity that has at its core, she writes, a history, vast and varied across country and across time periods, encompassing Aboriginal experience from pre-colonial to colonial and subsequent periods. It's represented in the oral or recorded memories of Aboriginal people. This history, she writes, is not past, it is not done with. I understand the anger and the sadness experienced by many Indigenous people each Australia Day. I have felt it, and at times I still do. But in my efforts to move beyond it, I cannot ignore the plight of my own people. I've crossed our country from the biggest cities to the red centre to our most northern tip. I have confronted the brutal reality of life for far too many. In Australian towns right now, children are kept awake by the cries of their mothers being beaten, their fathers locked in a spiral of hopelessness punctuated far too often by grog and drugs. In these Australian towns, to be 40 is to be old. Graveyards are marked by white crosses telling of lives gone too soon. In these Australian towns, people can live up to 30 to a home with no more privacy than the mangy dogs that share their beds. This is Australia. It happens in our country, a fate passed from generation to generation. Yet I have to ask myself, how does this explain me? If I am drawn from this same history, if my family has indeed endured the same struggles, what has put me here? How do I claim an identity in common with people who suffer when I enjoy a life of privilege? As I spoke to her, my mother, I felt the pain of her stories, but I also know that we are blessed to live in a country that is in so many ways the envy of the world. I have seen the worst of the world in a career spanning 3 decades. I've seen countries torn apart by war. I've seen people struggle against political oppression. I've seen the devastation that nature can wreak. I've stood in the blood of terrorist bombings, so thick that you can taste it in the back of your mouth. And I've watched mothers pick the flesh out of shrapnel-holed walls and smouldering buildings and place it in plastic bags, all they have left of their children to bury. I am thankful that our country is safe, prosperous, democratic, imperfect, yes, but committed to ideals of equality and justice. I pondered that dissonance this past Australia Day, our blessings and indeed our misery. I read an editorial published in one of our weekend newspapers written by an Indigenous woman who said she could not remain in Australia on Australia Day. She left, she said, to escape the toxicity of being an Aboriginal person. Australia Day, she wrote, was about the erasure of Aboriginal people. Far from being a part of the Australian dream, she said, Aboriginal people aren't allowed to have hope and freedom in this country. It is a sentiment that may resonate for some, but it cannot possibly tell our whole story. I have always seen hope. I saw it in my grandfather, who signed up to fight for this country in World War II, when his full citizenship was not recognised. He came home to a segregated land where he could not share a drink with the mates he served with, but never stopped believing in a better day. He led his family off the mission at Condobolin in New South Wales to walk 300 kilometres to the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area in Griffith to look for work. He fought to get his kids into the local schools and never weakened in his resolve for justice for his people. I've seen hope in the pioneers of the Indigenous political movement who fought for inclusion in this land and in 1967 won the most resounding referendum vote in our nation's history to fully count us in the census. I've seen the same hope in Charles Perkins' Freedom Ride of the 1960s that freed up the swimming pools and cinemas for Aboriginal people previously denied entry. The editorial accused Australia of pretending it is still terra nullius, the doctrine of an empty land that justified the British claim to this continent. But this, too, ignores the hope of a man named Mabo, who fought all the way to the highest court in this land to overturn terra nullius. We have hope, and we have freedom. It is a freedom built on those who have sacrificed before us, brave people, locked out of a country but looking for a way in. It is a freedom won with the love and support of those white Australians who have stood with Indigenous people, who have loved us and shared lives and, like my grandmother, had children with us, who have marched for reconciliation and shed tears when the Prime Minister said sorry. We have the freedom today to stand for office in any election in our land. Today we have more Indigenous people in our parliaments than ever before. In Ken Wyatt, we have the first ever Indigenous man serving as a federal government minister. We have the freedom to attend university, and we are graduating more people than ever before. Here's a statistic for you. There are almost four times the number of Indigenous university graduates than there are Indigenous people in prisons. We don't know that. We have our sports stars, our film stars, our music stars. This is not to be a Pollyanna. This is not to deny that we occupy the bottom rung still of every socioeconomic indicator. We die too young and we are overrepresented in our prisons. But there is another story here, and that story does not cling to a tale of woe. That is not rooted in a sense of victimhood. The history of dispossession can be an all too convenient explanation sometimes for what ails us. Like the editorial writer, I admit that I've been guilty at times of perpetuating what can be a lazy narrative that obscures a much more complete story of dynamism and potential. If our identities are chained to our histories, then perhaps it's time to look at that history again, to ask if clinging to grievance is not doing us more harm. One of the most challenging books I've read in recent times was David Reif's In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies. Reif, like me, has been a journalist whose reporting of suffering and war has forced him to question the idea that we must hold tight to our histories. Was the philosopher George Santayana right when he said, "Are those who cannot remember history condemned to repeat it?" Reif argues that, in fact, we make a fetish out of the past, turning it, he says, into a formula for unending grievance and vendetta. He writes, "This is what happened in the American South after 1865, and while diminished, is still happening today. It blighted the former Yugoslavia of the 1990s. Today it is endemic in Israel, Palestine, in Iraq and Syria, in the Hindu nationalist populism of India's Bharatiya Janata Party, jihadis and Islamists. Let there be no turning of a blind eye to the high price societies have paid and are continuing to pay for the solace of remembrance." These are tough words for me. Our struggle has been to have our stories remembered at all. As the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur once said, we have a duty to remember because by remembering we stopped the victims being killed twice. For much of our history, we suffered from what the great Australian anthropologist W.E.A. Stanner called the Great Australian Silence, a national amnesia he likened to a cult of forgetting. For many Aboriginal people locked in a cycle of sorry business, lives measured by the deadening drumbeat of funeral marches, it is indeed hard to let go. It is right to remember, but is it also right to forget? The French historian Ernst Renan said forgetting is an essential factor in the creation of a nation. And that is our task, to forge a nation. To make a nation that knits together those frayed fibres of ourselves and our history that tells a story that speaks to us all yet denies none. It presents itself as a simple question to me, and yet one that I've always asked and at times struggled with the answer. Am I an Australian? A Greek friend of mine once asked if it is not easier for a migrant to be Australian than an Aboriginal person. It's a question that sits at the heart of my quarterly essay, The Australian Dream, Blood, History and Becoming. I've tried to loose the chains of my history, to puncture that victim narrative. And what was revealed was a story not unlike that of the migrants themselves. What was revealed was a story of Aboriginal people who had survived the frontier. People who had been segregated, but when they had a chance, looked for a way to find a place in this society. As far back as Governor Macquarie's time, as he was overseeing the expansion of the colonial economy, integrating free settlers and former convicts, he encouraged Aboriginal people to be engaged with the local economy. Half a century later, the Aborigines Protection Board report of 1883 made it clear that, in the words of the time, half-castes were to be integrated into the state's economy. The protector George Thornton said, "I maintain the opinion I've always had with regard to the half-caste portion of the Aborigines, that they should be compelled to work in aid of their own requirements. They are well able to do so, having strength, experience and intelligence." Thornton called for the establishment of reserves. In effect, he saw them as migrant training camps. To enable them, he said, to form homesteads to cultivate grain, vegetables and fruit. Aborigines, he thought, could become farmers. If I fast forward to the 20th century, the book Survival Legacies by the architect Peter Caballa follows the trail of Aboriginal economic migrants. He maps the missions and settlements of New South Wales and tracks the movement of people. His book is rich with oral histories and reminiscences. His book challenges what he says is the continuous and persistent romanticisation of Aborigines. Aborigines, he said, in fact, became urban people. We became urban by moving. He talks about the Murrumbidgee irrigation area. He talks about that migration of people looking for work, my family story. But what was happening there was happening in other parts of the country as well. It's a story that sits alongside the popular story of resistance, violence and segregation, an alternative and very long history of economic accommodation. The anthropologist Ian Keane edited a study, Indigenous Participation in Australian Economies, that counters the relative invisibility, he said, of Aboriginal people in economic histories. Existing studies, he said, had neglected the degree of variation in both Indigenous economy and Indigenous participation in the national and colonial economy. This was especially adaptable to the pastoral and cattle industries. Aboriginal people could work seasonally or intermittently, living on ancestral land and still maintain aspects of traditional culture. As far back as the 19th century, the New South Wales South Coast, anthropologist John White showed how in the decade after first contact in the 1830s, local Aborigines and settlers had formed reciprocal economic relationships. One of these studies reveals that Aboriginal unemployment in the South Coast region fell more than 30% to as little as 4% during the period after World War II. Now, a decade later, Maria Lane, after those first reports were written, Maria Lane, an Aboriginal academic, probed the migration and the world that it's created. She observed two diverging Aboriginal populations. She saw a fledgling, what she called an open society, a society built around opportunity, effort and outcome-oriented, contrasting with an embedded society that became more risk-averse, welfare and security-oriented. The two populations, she said, are linked through kinship and continuing interaction, but the course of their lives was set by the great Aboriginal migration, what she called the slow grind. These were the people on the move from the 1940s to the 1970s, leaving settlements and missions, throwing off the heavy hand of government control, their journeys traced through my own family. When Lane picked up their story, the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of these pioneers were exploding into higher education. She focused on South Australia and found that in less than a decade, from the late 90s to the mid-2000s, the number of Indigenous students entering the last year of high school doubled, and of those number gaining good university entrances, the scores had tripled. These young, smart achievers were part of a population boom that Lane attributed to the increase of intermarriage between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. These were kids of the white and black worlds redefining what that meant for them. Between 1996 and 2006, the Indigenous community was transformed. The numbers of educated, well-paid professionals exploded in just a decade. It increased by nearly 75%. That was more than double the increase in the non-Indigenous community. By 2006, more than 14,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders between the ages of 20 and 64 were employed in professional occupations, 13% of the Indigenous workforce. Dr. Julie Lahn from the Australian National University looked on this phenomenon in a paper entitled Aboriginal Professionals, Work, Class and Culture, and she said, Aboriginal professionals in urban centres remain overlooked, and that impedes a fuller understanding of the processes of transformation that are increasingly evident to Aboriginal people themselves. And we see this in our universities. There are around 30,000 university graduates in Australia. In 1991, there were fewer than 4,000. Those students who are breaking through are creating a new narrative of empowerment and individuality. This is the emergence of a new Indigenous middle class, of which I am assuredly a part. And it presents new questions for identity. That I am an Indigenous person is a fact of my birth. My father, a Wiradjuri man from central and southwest New South Wales, and my mother from the Gamilaroi people of the state's northwest. But that is not all I am. I am, in fact, drawn from white and black. I'm someone who has transcended the history of suffering that many of my people, and indeed my family, endured to find a place in this modern Australia. The reality of my identity is more ambiguous, defying easy definition. To borrow from Franz Kafka, identity is a cage in search of a bird. I was born into the society that emerged from the Australian frontier, a hybrid society that married each other, repopulated on missions and settlements. These are the people for whom we were forecast to die out. But we didn't die out. We have survived, and we are surviving and succeeding in spite of the history. There is a vigorous debate now emerging within the Indigenous community, straining at narrow ideas of identity. Identity that can feel like a straitjacket. Yin Paradies is an example of someone with Indigenous heritage, but chafing at orthodox interpretations of identity. He's an academic of Indigenous, Anglo and Asian heritage. As he says, he's both coloniser and colonised. He represents both black and, in his words, consummately white. He describes a prison house of identity. That means his efforts to express a hybrid sense of himself lead to attacks on his own authenticity, sometimes being called a coconut, brown on the outside, white on the inside, or a 9-to-5 black taking a job from a real Aborigine. Now, he's typical of many urban Indigenous people whose circle of friends are non-Indigenous, often have little contact with extended family. He doesn't deny that Aboriginal people have suffered a history of marginalisation, discrimination and exclusion, but he says that doesn't solely define him today. Some Indigenous people have begun to explore the impact of this middle class, recognising it as a phenomenon that can be met with suspicion, even hostility by some in the Indigenous community. The Indigenous lawyer, academic and broadcaster Larissa Berendt, in an article for The Guardian, Who's Afraid of the Indigenous Middle Class?, identified a fracture in Aboriginal communities and politics between an old guard forged in anger, loyal to the power of protest, and a new generation seeking to work within the system, to join political parties, to join the professions and seek to make a change. And Berendt identifies a critical question at the heart of this. How does a community that has partly been defined by its exclusion, disadvantage and poverty redefine itself? How does it increase its participation in the mainstream and not be assimilated? Behrendt ultimately argues that a person's cultural identity should not be tied to poverty. You are not more Aboriginal if you grew up struggling. We are free to define ourselves and what being Indigenous means. The new black middle class is developing its own consciousness, and some perhaps embracing a cosmopolitan identity beyond the mob. Indigenous identity today is complex, diverse, lacerated by class, gender, geography. Individuals seek to express themselves apart from their communities. In this way, we are no different to other peoples. I'm inspired by the works of philosophers like Amartya Sen and Kwame Anthony Appiah. Sen has warned of the dangers of exclusive, solitarist identities that are framed around division. He believes this makes our world inflammable. As a reporter who has spent 3 decades walking the fault lines and the tripwires of geopolitics and seeing up close how age-old enmity and politics of identity can pit people against each other, I can only concur. Appiah counsels us to look beyond our parochial ideas to a shared sense of ourselves. Difference is to be celebrated, culture and community cherished, yes, but he says we should remain open to all of life's rich tapestry. His philosophy is captured in the words of the playwright Terence, a man bought and sold as a slave in ancient Rome, who before the birth of Christ wrote words that survive today. Homo sum, humani nihil, ami alienum puto. I am human, and nothing of that which is human is alien to me. This is the lesson I draw from my ancestors, the people who endured that loss of certainty, the collapse of the golden house of Is that Czeslaw Milos wrote about, who survived, looked for a way in, who struggled and inspire still the struggle today. Economically and socially, individual Indigenous people are closing the gap. But there are many questions still to be answered politically, questions beyond the scope of my discussion tonight, but questions that go to our place in Australia, that answer that question. Can we call ourselves Australians? The solutions to these challenges are complex and often contradictory. But when I hear the voices of our past, when I look on the extraordinary achievements of my forebears, I know one thing, that we can walk in this world, we can belong to our world, and we can prosper. I want to close by returning to Eleanor Dark's novel, The Timeless Land. That moment that she imagines the becoming of the boy Bennelong. A boy raised in certainty, confronted by a new people, a boy who would take that journey and touch a distant shore, and whose journey still speaks to Indigenous people today. As she writes of Bennelong, then an old man, she says he has met the bone-pale strangers and sailed in their winged boat to a far off shore. He stood with kings and learned of gods beyond his own. He's been speared now. He is wounded. He no longer dwells in the certainty of his people. Some of his people look on him as a stranger. There was no single enemy, white or black. It was as if the very earth itself had played him false. As Dark imagines Bennelong, he speaks to us through the ages. I, Bennelong, I am great. I am taller than the trees and stronger than the storm. I am wiser than the fathers of our tribes, for I have been to England and I have seen the king, and now I know many things, and I will teach you what I have learned. Thank you.
Many thanks, Stan Grant. Anne's got copies of the quarterly essay, The Australian Dream, and of Stan's first book, The Tears of Strangers, and of Stan's middle book, Talking to My Country, and I'm sure our speaker would be happy to sign copies. after the talk. And so we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, so I ask you to be brief with your comments or questions. I'll just start off. You're probably one of Australia's most successful journalists, many years with CNN, Sky News, SBS, and now the ABC. You start your speech tonight with quotes from Eleanor Dark. So obviously, in the very poor background you had in rural New South Wales, you obviously had something driving your education. You're obviously someone who's obsessed with reading, with books. So explain that kind of background, how it comes that a poor kid growing up in the environment you trace starts developing this great interest in reading, which you've continued into your current sphere.
That's a fantastic question. And it goes to the type of education that I had. My mother and father were itinerant. My father was a labourer, mostly a sawmiller. And ours was a life lived on the road. I did not have a place I could call home, at least for the first 13 or 14 years of my life. It was a life spent on the back roads of New South Wales, moving from town to town. We lived in caravans. We slept in the back of cars. We lived in shacks on the outskirts of town. My father took work wherever he could find it. My mother sometimes had to rely on the charity of churches and welfare agencies to put food on the table. I didn't really go to school consistently until I was about 13 or 14. I would start and move and start and move. I changed schools at least 14 or 15 times before I was even into my teens. A couple of weeks here and a month there and a couple of months away from school and picking it up again. But I was fascinated by books. I loved stories. I loved sitting with we are a storytelling people. My mother, my father, my grandfather would tell us stories, vivid stories of the past and their lives, cultural stories, historical stories. And I developed a passion for reading. And my mother, wherever she could, with as little money as we had, would find a book for me in the second-hand bins or discarded books from the churchyards or the second-hand stores. But she would always find books, and sometimes books that were completely inappropriate for my age. You know, I'm sitting there reading books of Greek mythology when I was 7 or 8. I remember reading Steinbeck and Dickens and the great authors when I was 6, 7 years old, Robert Louis Stevenson, and things that really fired my imagination. But whatever I could get, I read. I read newspapers constantly. I watched the television news and I listened to the radio news constantly. Books were my education. They were my way of connecting to the world beyond my own. As Eleanor Dark imagines Bennelong imagining other worlds, I saw other worlds through books. And I looked at my own life and I compared my life to others. I compared my life and our lives to the lives of those in those books. And books have been a constant source of entertainment and education and fascination for me throughout my entire life. I read poetry, I read philosophy, I read history, I read politics, and all of it, I try to bring into my own experience and look for lives beyond my own, so that I'm not trapped in the history that we've inherited, a history that we know holds so many of my own people, our people, Australian people, still today. Books gave me a way of imagining something else. Books gave me a way of making sense of my life and asking questions, always, always asking questions.
There's a question here. Let me go up here. Okay, sorry. You have to talk right into it. Okay.
Thank you. I just want a statement, really. How can we put your book, Talking to My Country, onto the school curriculum?
Oh, I have no idea how to do that, but if you know, I'd love to do it. It would certainly boost boost sales. Look, I have a publisher. You know, they have these concerns.
I think it's very...
I think it's important. I think it's important for us all to talk, and I think it's important for us all to understand each other, and I think it's important for us as Indigenous people to imagine what life is like for non-Indigenous people, and for non-Indigenous people to imagine our lives. I look for that connection. I always say I inherited the Blarney and the dreaming. And I look for the Irish and the Aboriginal, because they are part of me. I always say that I could not have been born anywhere else but here. There is no other place in the world that could have created me and my family. We are born of the people of the first footprints on this land, and we are born of the people who came here. And it is an Australian story. I don't like to see it as a story in opposition. I don't like to see it as a story of exclusion. I don't like the idea that I identify as something that someone else is not. I am who I am, but I am part of you as well. And I think that's the essence of everything I try to write.
Question here. I read the speech of another great Indigenous speaker a little while ago, David Unaipom.
Yes.
In the
1920s, yes.
He was a big, very successful public speaker. And he was recorded as talking about the injustice of the white people to Aborigines, then thought to be numbered in about 90,000, that only 10,000 of them had received the Bible. And he thought it was an atrocity that, you know, so many had missed out. Mm. And I know in your family story, you mentioned in another book, your grandfather kept a King James Bible and a Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. By his bed.
By his bed. How did that particular book affect your family story and what you're looking at and those who didn't? What's the difference?
The Christianity was essential to us. I know later there has been a revisionist idea that Christianity was a destructive force in our lives, and there is no doubt that in the effort and the rush to Christianize and civilize, in inverted commas, that there was a tendency to see Indigenous culture as something that should be put aside. It should be languages and cultural practices. But it did bring something else to our lives. I was raised in the black church, the church on the mission at Griffith that my grandfather had preached in and my uncle had preached in. The church gave us a hierarchy. It captured that essence of that Aboriginal hierarchy that otherwise may have been lost or destroyed. When someone who had a few drinks had walked past my uncle, they'd always sort of straighten up a little bit as they went by just to make sure the pastor didn't get them in trouble. It was important to us. And it doesn't mean that we can't include all aspects of ourselves. Our traditional belief in a creator called Bayami, a creator who we could identify through the Bible. The creation stories were analogous to the creation stories in the Bible. Now, you know, as I've grown older and I've been introduced to other ideas and other philosophies and other religions, I've broadened my own ideas about religion, about its place in the world, but I've never lost that essential appreciation for the fact that it gave a purpose and a meaning and a substance to our lives that cannot be underestimated. And it gave me a great love of words and stories too. And it gave my grandfather a great sense of resilience, that he believed that God had endowed him with the same qualities as other human beings. And no man could take that away from him. It was vitally important to himself and how he saw the world, and he incorporated that into a strong sense of himself as a Wiradjuri person that never wavered.
So very briefly, before we go to the next question, the Christian denomination was?
Oh, well, it was an evangelical religion. I mean, we were mixed, actually, because I have the Irish Catholic ancestry, and that's been very important to me. My boys go to a Catholic school, and, you know, that's been very important. But on the missions, it was an evangelical sort of mishmash of Protestantism. But later, in the 1970s, an Aboriginal political Christian leadership emerged, of an Aboriginal evangelical fellowship that had a big influence right around the world, right around Australia. And indeed, much of the Aboriginal political leadership emerged from the missions and emerged from Christianity. William Cooper in the 1930s, one of the early political activists, emerged from the church. Doug Nicholls, Pastor Doug Nichols emerged from the church. The church, William Ferguson, emerged from the church. An uncle of mine, actually.
Okay, there's a question here.
Stan, how do you think your sons see their identity as Australians?
I hope they wear it a lot. I hope, well, as Australians, I think they find themselves very comfortably in Australia. And I think it's been a progression. There is no doubt for my parents, their place in Australia has been contested. It's been a hard one. But they are patriotic people, my parents, and they have a love of the country and a love of their people. For me, the struggle has been reconciling those things, reconciling the history with my own journey, opening my mind to other ideas, trying to see past the worst of us to see the best of us. For my boys, they've lived in China. They've lived in the Middle East. They've lived in Europe. They have friends from all around the world. They are comfortable walking in the world. They have a strong sense of themselves as Wiradjuri, Gamilaroi people. They are strongly identified with their Indigenous heritage, but they are not just that. And I encourage them, and indeed they do this naturally, to feel as if they have a place in the broad multicultural fabric of this country, a place like everybody else, a unique place, but a place that also sees them able to find themselves in other people. I am human, therefore nothing that is human is alien to me. That's how I hope my boys see the world.
Stan, I'm fascinated by the connection with the Irish, because in my own view of looking back in history, the Irish seem to be the group in Australia that most readily empathised with the Indigenous, in the sense that many have Irish names, many Indigenous
yes.
names. Maybe because they married them.
Yes, they did.
Or because they were both downtrodden. Because as you describe the way in which Indigenous Australians have come through their persecution, or whatever you'd like to call it, their feeling that they have lost their own ancestry, whatever, in terms of being taken over, so were the Irish.
Mm.
To what extent does this make a sort of bridge? And is there something to be learned from the way the Irish have emerged in this century and later in the last century as independent of the British and much more their own people?
Yeah, it's a very different story, of course, the Irish story and the Indigenous story, and the numbers are very different and so on. But I do think that there was an empathy, I suppose, and I don't want to make too much of this. There weren't many women around. and, you know, if you're an Irish convict or a convict of any kind, who are the only women? They're Aboriginal women. And we were born out of that. But there's no doubt, if you look at the number of Aboriginal people who have that Irish ancestry, you know, just look at the names, the Dodsons and the O'Donoghues and the O'Shanes. You know, it is a very, very common thing. And I think it did go to an empathy, but I don't want to make too much of that inheritance of oppression that solely defines you. I think in Australia, strangely, people have asked me a lot about Australia and Australia's relationship to history. I've worked in countries where history hangs very heavily. I've always thought that Australia is a place that people come to escape history in many respects, and all to the good. As David Riff has pointed out, an historical attachment to grievance can shatter people. And I've seen this all around the world. And in Australia, we do manage to wear that history a little more lightly, much more difficult for Indigenous people. You know, the blazing sun of history still burns in us. But we can find a place in Australia beyond our history, and we can find a place where we see each other in ourselves. And I don't like to get too caught up in that. It's part of my story, but I like to look to the new story that we can write here as well.
Now we're getting to...
They are.
We're getting to the end. If I miss anyone down here, let me know. Is that Mike?
Sam, but as a journalist particularly, you're a leader in your community, and you're also, of course, a journalist of distinction. How do you balance the two roles, and how do you... as professionally stand back and see how the media cover Indigenous matters? Has it changed? What needs to be done?
I'm sort of reluctant to embrace that idea of being a leader in... My father is a leader in my community. He is an elder in our community, and he has a great store of knowledge and respect as a result of that. I'm a journalist and I tell stories and I try to make sense of the world. You know, there is no one story. There is no one truth to all of this, but many different ways that we can interpret our past and our history. And I see my role being someone who can write about these experiences, write about the experience from my own point of view, my family's history, write about my experiences as someone who has lived away from Australia for a long time, looking back on my country, and also writing about it as someone who can see from the other side as well, who can connect with white Australia, hopefully, and see how they may see us. I'm unapologetically diplomatic. I look for diplomacy. I look to leave room to engage. I look to leave room for us to be able to speak to each other, because I've seen what happens when you can't speak to each other.
So finally, you've written 2 books in a year now, and one about a decade before that.
Yes.
Do you see yourself now moving into a writing career as well as your extensive journalism? And if so, what's number four?
I am working on a couple of things. I'd like to pull together a book of essays and speeches and things that I've done that have a theme that explores my own journey, really, my own journey in trying to come to terms with our history and how we see ourselves in this country, and work through some of those, my own challenges, and perhaps that would resonate with other people. I'm fascinated by the Bennelong story. The Bennelong story, to imagine a man who sees white people for the first time and then gets on a boat and goes to England. And he stays there for 3 years. 3 years. To come back to this place with experiences that no other of his people had had. And then to try to make sense of that. I think it's a wonderful gateway into the story of us. It's not a story simply of dispossession and oppression. That's part of it. It's not a story of exclusion and segregation only. That is a part of it. But it's the human story of people meeting each other, finding themselves in each other. Why did we marry? Why did we have children? Why did we work together? Why did my grandfather sign up to fight a war for a country that didn't fully acknowledge him? Bennelong is the beginning of the story of how we connect in this country. I would love to work on that and to write that. It's a bigger project, but it's in the back of my mind.
Many thanks.
Lovely. Thank you, Jerry.
So, once again, thanks to Coors Chambers Westgarth for the use of this fine facility this evening, and thanks to our speaker. I'm sure if when you do put out a collection of your work, this speech tonight will be in it. It's an important address and a beautifully written address, and a very memorable occasion. So we're very grateful you came here. As I said to earlier on, we've got copies of Stan's 3 books, and I hope sometime in the not too distant future you'll come back and talk about 4 and possibly 5. So, but for tonight, congratulations and good
Thank
luck.
You.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.